Hello and welcome, and coming up on the latest Serie A Awesome podcast, a full midweek of action. But does anybody really care? Because it's all been about the European Super League. Of course they care. Inter is at another point towards a first title since 2010. And then at the foot of the table, Cagliari with a win, but teams around them also picking up points. Mark Donaldson, alongside Nicky Bandini and Mina Rizzucchi. Now, just a little point of order before we get started on our European Super League chat. There's someone beside Mina, probably in the next house or whatever, who has a drill. So you may from time to time hear that. Mina is creating a special 12-person loft. The only elite access is possible. It may or may not work, Mina, so we will just wait and see. But if there is a drill noise over the next hour or so, that is exactly what it is.
Yes, it's me trying to keep out the riffraff. No one earns their place over here. I decide.
The big story of the week, it's the one that's been on everybody's lips. Why was João Pedro's first goal at Udinese yesterday in our commentary game on ESPN chalked off by VAR? Yes, there was a foul, but understandably, I suppose, and ultimately, it was the correct decision. One or two other kind of and finally stories this week, including some Super European League or whatever it's called, where the rats have now deserted the sinking ship. However, Nicky Bandini, are they still rats?
I'm not sure how to field the question of whether or not they're rats. It's been such a week, Mark. I can't tell you. I can't tell anyone who's listening to this how many rewrites and lost stories there have been in this week for some of us, because this story has gone at a million miles an hour. Certainly, to look at it from the Italian perspective, these three clubs have done themselves no favours whatsoever. We were just talking before we started the podcast about how just absolutely chaotic this whole story has been from, I guess, a leadership standpoint, from a management standpoint. And the fact that in this midweek round that we've just had, you had all of these directors, Paolo Maldini at Milan coming out and saying, I didn't know anything about this until Sunday afternoon when the rest of you found out. And Beppe Marotta at Inter, Beppe Marotta, you know, someone of influence, someone who you think would be involved in high-level conversations, saying, look, this was a project of the owners, they carried it forward, I wasn't involved in it. Not necessarily washing their hands of it completely. It was interesting. Maldini was still at pains to apologise. He wanted to be the person apologising to the fans about it. Marotta sort of said, look, I wasn't involved in it, but you have to understand, football is in this place now where we're at a serious risk of default, and sort of making this economic case for it. But putting that aside for a second, because that's one conversation, I'm just astonished that these clubs, Juventus, Milan and Inter, thought they could launch something so ambitious, so controversial, so distasteful to a lot of us who do think that meritocracy is important, and if you take that away, you're taking something away from football. The fact that they thought they could do it without telling their own, not just their own staff, but their own directors, and launching this website at midnight on a Sunday after midnight in Italy, it's been an astonishing story. I'm simultaneously absolutely overflowing with words about it, because there's been so much to say, and also a little bit lost for words trying to explain how this happened.
Mina, this is something that I think has been best described over the past few days as either a boys' or a girls' night out without telling the partner and then facing the consequences afterwards.
Isn't that what one does anyway? I'm joking. Right. I think I share the sentiment of what Nicky is saying, in the sense that, you know, when that you're just bubbling with so much that you want to say, but it's so difficult to sometimes eloquently express your feelings about something, about, you know, the facts of the matter at hand and how we can discuss this in the best way possible, in which we try to provide unbiased coverage of these decisions. It's clear that this is a group of men that feel the way that the football landscape is right now doesn't serve them or doesn't or is even sustainable. And while there are some merits to their argument, what they are trying to do goes against the very notion of sport, of meritocracy, of earning your place. And so while we can argue with the fact that, and I will continue to argue this point until it's very clear, UEFA are never the champion of the people. They have never been an organizational body that I will stand behind and give my support to. Seferin is acting like the man who... there are so many issues to take part into it. I think that Nicky's done a great job of telling you that there are many directors that didn't know what was going on. Juventus did come out and speak to their players and speak to their members of staff before going into it. But again, very late into the game. The way this is handled is nothing but uncouth and inelegant, if we are to just be polite about all of this. It's just all of a sudden we've agreed this Champions League format, we're picking up calls to different members of the European, you know, governing body and other directors, and bam, Sunday night, we've created this and we're out. Ciao. It doesn't make any sense. Having said that, I do think that it's important to maybe reference a few things. One is the statement released by the Milan ultras. They're ultras, so they're never going to be people that necessarily, you know, garner affection for what they said. But I do think what they say is interesting in the sense that European football has been heading that way for so long. This isn't the first time that we've seen a chasm being created. If you look at the new Champions League format, there is no such thing as meritocracy there. There is a bigger semblance of it than there is in the Super League, for sure. But with the new Champions League format, if, let's say, Juventus had dropped out of the top four and someone like Sassuolo had gotten in, by the sheer fact that the history of Juventus has been one that is more successful than Sassuolo's in the Champions League, they would get that place. And so there are places being offered to teams that haven't earned their place in the top four. They might have earned it in the top seven, but if you have history behind you, you need to finish in the top seven, not in the top four. So meritocracy is something that is a notion that has been eroding in sport, or at least in football. When Seferin was being accused by Javier Tebas, who is the leader of, you know, the Spanish football system and, you know, La Liga, and he said to him, "You're only listening to the big boys and not to the small boys," despite the fact Tebas is a long-time Real Madrid supporter, he said, "Oh, this is not productive. You telling me this is not productive. The way to always stir content and make sure that you provoke anger is by always screaming, 'The rich are coming, the rich are coming.'" And now he's the man who's standing opposite the rich and no longer, you know, the man that they all look to or his befriending them. And all of a sudden he feels what it's like to no longer be that man. And I just feel like there are so many, we've known this was going to happen. This was always the way that football was heading because it's become ridiculous. We've seen the Mina Raiola taking Haaland around. We've seen how much he's demanding for the likes of Donnarumma to extend his contract. These are ridiculous things that are happening in football that makes it no longer sustainable or fun to watch.
I think it's really interesting, actually, sorry, just to pick up off that, Mark. I think it's really interesting to contrast something that Mina touched on there, which is how those Milan ultras, they weren't alone. I think the general voice of the supporters, I mean, we are talking about ultras, which is a category of sport, and I think it's always important to specify that there can be very different ideas between ultras and tifosi and fans in Italy, that they are groups that overlap, but they can have very distinct voices on some issues. But I do think where we've heard the ultras, not just from Milan, there is this very strong sense of this was terrible. This was a bad idea.
Yes.
But you're all being hypocrites about how terrible things were already.
Yes.
And I think that's a very, it's very hard to give you like a, this is what Italians think, because Italians don't all think alike, and same as it does in any country. But I think that when you look at, for instance, the English reaction and perhaps the English language reaction as well, because I feel like there was quite a lot of shared conversation between maybe American audiences and English audiences on this. There was a sort of united front of fury, whereas in Italy, there was more nuance. There was sort of more, we don't like this, but... I think it's worth saying in that that doesn't mean everyone was doing that sort of softening either. And I think that actually some of the messages that hit me hardest, and I thought one in particular, for some reason, can't even tell you fully why, but Roberto De Zerbi in his press conference before this game, where he said, I don't even want to play Milan on Wednesday night. He said, if it was up to me, I wouldn't go. If my boss tells me to go, I'll go. But he went into this this conversation about, look, you know, football is something that has given me a great livelihood, but I've given my life to it as well. And to take away from me and from other people in football the possibility of meritocracy, that's really something that hurts me. And I think, again, it's sometimes it's not just the words, it's how things are delivered. But I really felt him in that moment. I really felt this person who was hurt by something. And that is the thing which I think is going to be hardest ultimately to repair in some of these relationships. Because look, the Super League isn't happening now. Mm. And so we're kind of already on to what happens next.
A lot of this is dripping with hypocrisy. And the one thing I want to point out as well, and I know this is a Serie A awesome podcast, but there was a reason why that statement on Sunday evening was released when it was. Now, obviously, Nikki and Mina, you're in bed by 10 p.m. on a Sunday. Of course, well, you have to be now because it's the laws of the land, apparently. You can't drink after that, so you're in bed. So you've got no idea.
Well, the games have only just finished on a Sunday night in Italy at 10 p.m. UK time, 11 p.m.
But you're so good
so...
that you can have it submitted straight away and then off to bed you pop. So the likelihood is that this wasn't a thing for the UK audience, and to an extent, nor for the US audience either. This was designed at midnight on Sunday evening, Monday morning, for the opening of the Asian markets. This is not about Italians, about English, about Scottish or whoever. This is something bigger. This is a whole group of men who just have so poorly read the room. But ultimately, it's not for your fans in the stands. It's for your subscribers in India and Asia and elsewhere that are going to plow money into something. How can some people so badly read a room?
Wait, so Mark, by what your statement says, which I think is a very interesting one, are you saying that one fan can matter more than the other? Are we only now... Let's put this in another way. Juventus had a rise of 68% in subscriptions, in viewership, mm-hmm. and everything when Ronaldo came. So are we saying the people that go and watch them in the Allianz Stadium are worth more than those ones who are now plowing all the money in, buying the merchandise that regular Italian families might not be able to do because they don't have the economy of Germany and England? And so how can there can be competition from countries like Spain and Italy when they don't have the economic landscape that other countries have in Europe? And so what we're saying is if you are a fan in India, you don't matter as much as if you're a fan in England, because I'm sorry to tell you this, it's not a global game. It belongs to the people that go to the matches.
Well, hang on.
I think it's the opposite.
I mean, that's a giant can of worms, because we're not just talking about the value of a fan in abstract. We're talking about the meaning of a club. And you are, I mean, I agree that this is what clubs are thinking. I agree that this is what clubs are starting to ask themselves, because they view themselves as a global product. But at that point, if you go down that road of, look, our fan there is as valuable as our fan here, do Juventus need to play their home games in Turin, or could they just play them anywhere? Are they a franchise like an American sports team that can relocate anywhere in the world and stuff their roots? Maybe you agree with that, but I certainly personally am in the camp that finds that thought, I don't know what the right word is. Offensive is the one that's in my head right now. I don't know if that's the one that I want to settle on, but I think it's awful to take something that has a historic roots in a place and say, doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what connection you have to the place that you started out. That's meaningless. All that matters is the number on the bank balance at the end. And to me, as someone who came into football journalism as a fan, because most of us do, we don't just start writing about football for no reason, I find that a huge, huge turnoff. And if all of the sport was like that, my interest in it would be hugely diminished.
I think that's part of the backlash as well, Nikki, because as Mina was talking about, all the countries that you mentioned, Mina, were all European countries. I think this is them trying to think, you know what, we've got this big global game. And ultimately, if you've got these 10 or these 12 Super League clubs, Do you really think that we're going to have a Juventus against Milan played 1 week in Turin and then the reverse fixture in Milan? No, of course not. They want to take it all over the place. They want to make it a global game. And that's why I think you're both right in that what Nicky's saying and that the fans in the stands have in essence been devalued. That's why I think they've read the room so wrong. But for me, the bigger picture is to take the games and to have more subscribers in India. It's not a case of them being less important. I think at times they're talking about the Indians and the Asians being more important because look, I mean, when we sit here, I'm in the United States, you two are in the United Kingdom over here. How much do we really know about China? How much do we really know about India and the population that they have there? How much do we really know about Southern Africa, where, especially Nigeria, where they watch so much football? We don't really know too much. All we know is about what we actually do, whether it's commentate, whether it's write, or whether whatever it is. We don't know this population. They may have explored that, and that's an angle that they want to go down. But they've forgotten about what matters most, the bread and butter, the fans, the history, and those in the stadium. They don't care about that, and that's why they deserve to have what's happened.
I mean, no. Of course, the great sort of extra element is, sorry, I mean, I'll be quick and I'll get out of the way and you can pick up. But the great extra element of this is, you know, part of the reason we are here, part of the reason this happened now, I think it would have happened anyway, but part of the reason it happened right now is because there are no fans in the stands, because there is no gate receipts right now, because this pandemic has shut down stadiums. And I mean, the question of how we relate to our sports teams and how that has been influenced by this last year, I think that's a sociological question, frankly, that's going to be explored at length in the coming years when stadiums reopen again.
You see, I think that there's a lot of existential and philosophical and anthropological questions that have been thrown into all of this. You know, who is the fan that we cater for now? What generation is the generation that that matters or will matter? The way that football has been so appealing, especially to, let's say, my mom and dad's generation. It was what introduced me to football. I am a foreigner because I've always loved a football that came from another country that I didn't live in. I grew up in London and I didn't follow the Premier League. It's of very little interest to me and has been for many years. And yet it's something I work in, but if you ask me what I love watching Italian football. It always has been since day one. And I feel like I'm someone who knows the history of my club or the one that I support. I will tell you details of even their personal love lives. I will know it, you know? But, and I feel like I should matter as much as the person who goes into the stadium. But that is a different point, you know, altogether, because I do, you know, there is, of course, something different between being a franchise and a club rooted in its history and its location. Having said all of these things, you know, we have to understand that I think this is the point of things. Like, this is where I tell you that there are ways in which I apologize, the drilling has started.
I'm just glad it started because I referenced something that so far we've heard nothing of at the beginning.
I thought it was just the momentum of Mina's argument. She's getting into it. She starts to.
This is my background noise. Yes, exactly. But I guess this is what.
Angry dentist downstairs.
But I think that, you know, as a club, what happens if you are CEO or you are a member, you know, of the directive? What do you call management, rather? Sorry, I'm starting to lose my mind with all the different languages I've had to speak over the last few days. But if you are, you do get, you know, these pamphlets, you get these like studies being given to you about how to appeal to a different generation. You know, what is happening now is the globalization of sport, it's the globalization of people. We have things like Twitter and social media to bring us all together. And what they're saying, I guess, what the point of the Super League was, is that since we're headed that way and the football has become a business because no one spoke up when foreign enterprises were coming in and buying these clubs, no one was speaking up when agents started to make ridiculous demands, no one spoke up when broadcasting revenues were getting so ridiculous, and yet our prices were going up as fans, merchandise was going up for fans. You know, there was nobody there who was fighting that fight. It's only now that everyone has stood together, which is where the hypocrisy comes out of all of this. And all of a sudden, there's a moral standpoint. So you're happy to take the money of these pesky foreigners that we keep referring to as petrodollars or whatever it is. But when it comes to now trying for them to let's say, at least accrue some sort of profit, to do more than have only 16 profitable balance sheets out of 72 that have come out in 2008. They are making losses. This is not sustainable. Mino Raiola isn't a man that should exist in football right now, even if, you know, he sounds like my name. At this point, things need to change. And I think the Super League taught us that there is a generation. People can laugh about Perez however they want. Generation Z do want to watch football, but they have to find it engaging. They will concentrate for long periods of time. The fact is that the German DFL did commission a study to see how long and how interested they are in football. Millennials were the strongest when it came to their interest in sport. And I am a millennial, and I understand that because everyone in my generation shares this huge desire to consume sport on all levels. But the younger kids, there are so many things that entertain them. And unless something's engaging, it doesn't get their interest. That's not to say that football isn't, but maybe Burnley, Southampton or Spezia versus Crotone is not what they want to watch. So how do we make this more appealing to them? Let's provide a product that's adaptable, that can go for the global audience, that does engage the neutral, that brings the kids on board, because life is changing, football's changing, we're working from homes, there's pandemics, we don't know what's happening. The way that's gone about it, the lack of dialogue, making people feel excluded, that is everything that is wrong with the Super League and everything that Gen Z especially would hate. But I also think that the elitist outrage at something that is considered an elitist competition, I find quite shocking. The way that it's like, oh my God, I cannot believe that you're not catering to these people. We are so above. Oh, this American franchise system, how belittling. This, for me, is what outraged me, because, you know, if I am a foreigner, then I'm never going to feel part of it if I'm not from one of these countries. And to constantly tell me that you know better doesn't make me be on your side either.
I want to take this forward, but first of all, I want to award you 12 points, Mina, one for each of the Super League teams, for a wonderful humble brag about the 83 languages that you speak when I'm struggling with English. So congratulations for that.
And very by the good way, at the humble brag.
Right, but subtle humble brag is better. It's not, look at me! It's a kind of just subtle. I like that. By the way, I said earlier about dripping with hypocrisy. People that are complaining or were behind Champions Leagues, where you don't even need to be a champion, a Europa League, where you don't even need to be in the competition at the start to win it at the end. Bring back the whole knockout stages, whereby it's two legs, or the one-off ties as they played during the pandemic. It made life a lot more interesting. Anyway, that's not possible. I want to take this forward, and I want to talk about those, first of all, the apologies, or kind of apologies, from Milan, from Juve, and from Inter. Inter's was kind of, yeah, okay, I suppose. Yeah, we might be that S word, but we don't want to say it. Milan, yeah, but... And Juve's like, yeah, what happened? There wasn't really a sorry like an Arsenal. And that's not really helping their cause either. So is there a danger for Milan, for Inter, and for Juventus that the owners in charge might come under enough pressure that they think, you know what, if the Super League's not working and I'm under pressure for what we've done, that they might think, I've had it with this. Mina?
I think most of the pod knows I'm a Juventus fan. And sadly, our president is very much the face of this alongside Florentino Perez. And so I do look at all these like forums that are there and discussion points and Instagram accounts. And I am one of those really sad people that goes through the comments of these places. Agnelli perhaps has come out looking the worst from all of this when it comes to Italian clubs, the way that the situation has been handled, the way that he's handled Seferin in general, and the comments made by Seferin about Agnelli. Having said all of that, all I read is, this is my president. This is a great man. This is, you know, this one family that has owned Juventus since practically the dawn of time. And while mistakes have been made, they're not somebody who necessarily associate him to being a man that isn't always out for their interests. And what they care about right now is that for them, sporting, what I keep reading is sporting meritocracy has meant that they dominated Italian football for 9 years. They reached the Champions League final twice. They've reached semifinals, and yet they're not even one of the 10 most valuable teams in the world. So there was never meritocracy in football. I mean, if Juventus can't even make it into the top clubs of the top 10, And how is Sassuolo ever going to win anything? So this notion of meritocracy doesn't seem to exist that much for fans of Juventus. And so I don't think there is a backlash. I think the English-speaking world is what, you know, Nikki was saying. I think fans who live in England and are fans of Juventus, like say I would be, are a little bit more disgusted by everything. People who live in America and Juventus fans are a little bit disgusted by everything. But fans in Italy, in, you know, of Juventus, there was one banner. The rest seem to be very happy to keep him on board. And while Maldini talks of what he talks, I don't think anyone wants to lose what they've got right now, either at Inter with Suning or at Milan. But Nikki might have a different opinion.
I think this is a question you get asked all the time as a journalist, not just in this situation, is what do the fans think? There's not like a button you can press which tells you what all the fans think. There's millions of fans who all have their different opinions. And the fact that we don't have full stadiums takes away one of the important ways that we can actually read something of the opinion of the fans, because you haven't got that in-stadium reaction. I definitely don't think Agnelli's getting a free pass in Italy. Now, of course, Italy has always been a partisan environment. Different people are pulling for different clubs and have different attitudes because of that. I think he's got a very hard road ahead of him in that job. And part of that, you referenced the Agnelli family, will come down to his relationship with his cousin, John Elkann, who's the one person who could just basically get rid of him if he decides that this project has been such a disaster that he has to move past it somehow. Because one thing no one's going to disagree on, I don't think, Agnelli is the person wearing this in Italy. Agnelli more than anyone else. And that's partly because of the role he had at the European Clubs Association within Italian football. And of course, then negotiating with UEFA for a better Champions League. His ideal version of the Champions League, he told us right before betraying it and walking out on it with, you know, this relationship with Čeferin, which is a soap opera, but God, I mean, this guy is literally the godfather of one of his daughters. It's wild to me, this whole way that went down with just switching your phone off on a Saturday and not talking to him. But that there are actually some quite sort of serious and, you know, difficult conversations that are going to happen about, for instance, Agnelli was a leading voice in the negotiations, the recent negotiations for Italy's latest batch of domestic TV rights. And one of the big proposals that was on the table was they were going to involve these private equity firms. They were going to set up a media company that was going to manage Serie A's rights going forwards. And these private equity firms were going to take a 10% stake in that. And that was going to generate a very large amount of money in a short-term way for Serie A clubs to help them manage the pandemic losses that everyone's dealing with. And in the end, seven clubs decided they didn't like it. They went against it and Serie A sold its domestic rights to DAZN instead. Now, the issue that has been raised is Agnelli was leading these negotiations at the same time that he must have known the Super League planning was happening. In fact, Urbano Cairo has made some reference to some registration that happened in January. And it has been reported by Calcio Finanza, which is a football finance website, and I'm sure others as well, that part of what the private equity firms wanted was a clause saying for the next 10 years, nobody can go off and join anything like a Super League that might detract from the product that we're getting ourselves involved in. So you can see how, looking at this from the outside, there are questions of conflict of interest. If you are doing the Super League project at the same time as you're negotiating a TV rights deal for Serie A, in which some people don't want a Super League project, shouldn't that have been something that you talked to all of the other clubs about? And these are questions that are not going to be easy for Agnelli to run away from, whether or not there's an answer that has not been produced yet, because this is not currently like an active legal case or anything, but there may be. But this is a big question and people are angry. People like Cairo, who of course, look again, the owner of Torino, it's a rival club. But these are not the straightforward fans don't like the Super League questions. These are big, high-level questions. And I think they're not going to go away quietly. I think Agnelli has got some big stuff he's going to be facing up to in the next weeks and months.
Just on the back of that, which I agree with you, there is that is conflict of interest, and that is why a lot of Inter also walked away from the table, because they were worried about that clause of the Super League. At the time when creating the Super League, they didn't think that it was going to impact what they call their bread and butter, which is Serie A, La Liga, Premier League. They thought all these things would stay intact and people wouldn't be outraged. This was just a competition to overtake UEFA Champions League. Of course, the meritocracy, the amount of money they would make would actually nullify and the everything else, really. It would just make it seem just so non-important. But on one thing that I do think matters with the Alcan story is that how can Agnelli do his job in Europe? He's no longer the president of ECA. Will he have the connections? Will Juventus be punished? What about the image of Juventus? I mean, at the end of the day, you do need a billionaire in charge of Real Madrid because of the fact that they do need, 15% to bankroll them should they go. That's how you become president with the socios. But when it comes to Agnelli, there is a replacement available. And so can this man mend the bridges? Can he get the godfather of his daughter back on board and Zeferin, Or are Juventus going to be punished going ahead? I think these are very, very excellent points made.
Yeah, and one tiny, tiny addendum to that. Giuseppe Gravina, the Italian Football Federation head, has already said there will not be sanctions, or at least he's not going to pursue sanctions domestically. He said, you can't sanction an idea, because the Super League never happened. So all it was was an idea. So that's where that is, if anyone's wondering.
It was a bit like the court in Madrid that said, well, we can't do anything if you're UEFA or FIFA, because it's not something that's actually happened as yet. And until we get more information about this, we can't exactly ban people from doing that. Finally, the final point on this super duper European League, or whatever they wanted to call it, is this. And I just want a one word answer from both of you, either yes or a no. We've heard various fads, like the 39th game in the Premier League, let's take them to Asia or whatever. We've heard of the Atlantic League, which is like the top clubs in the lesser leagues in Europe kind of breaking away. They were just fads. They went, and at times they come back. Will the European Super League come back and be a thing, or won't it? Yes or no? Nikki?
I can't do that in one word. I'm sorry, Mark. That's asking too much of me. I will be quick. I think that the desire that these club owners have to do something to resolve the problems they're having financially will not go away, and therefore they will keep pushing for solutions that are not necessarily in everyone else's interest. They're going to look after their own interests. So I don't necessarily think it's done forever, but whether or not they will try this thing again, this exact model, I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think they're just going to keep ramming their head against the wall.
Mina?
I do want to say, if you're a fan, everything that you read, please check it. Even why PSG won't be involved. Look at the connections that they have with UEFA. Look at the rights they have. Always think of everything before you make a decision. Don't believe anyone at their word. There's no one in this industry who's clean. Will it come back? Yes. The model right now is unsustainable. Unless they all come together and figure out a way of not hemorrhaging this much money, where there are some clubs that can spend 400 million on two guys that lead their attack. I think something needs to change. So I don't think the idea will go away. I think the idea and its current guise will. I don't think they would ever dare to talk about something like this again, against the sporting values that we all hold so dear. But I don't think this is going away.
There was an old journalism colleague of mine from the old school that once said, if there's quotes in an article, you can believe it. If there's not, move on. As we will next to the midweek action in Serie A. And Udinese against Cagliari might get a mention, but not too much of a mention, because Inter and
really
Juve,
like this game,
and Milan.
Yeah.
I had to commentate through it for 90 minutes of my life that I'm never going to get back. That's why it's getting referenced, and it's had too much reference so far. So it won't be spoken about too much when we come back on Serie Awesome. Well, since the last Serie Awesome podcast, most teams have played twice, including a full round of midweek action. We'll get to the champions-elect Inter shortly, but I want to start, Mina, with Juventus and a defeat at Atalanta at the weekend. And when they went a goal down to Parma, you kind of thought, uh-oh, what is happening here? But then they turned it around. Where does that leave Juventus in the minds of their supporters, Mina?
I think it's been a, I mean, a, it's been a roller coaster of emotions this week, but for Juventus this season and for their fans, it's been a, really a roller coaster. One thing that I can say is Juventus no longer intimidate their opponents. Once upon a time, you see that black and orange jersey on the pitch, and if you are the opponent, you're scared. You're already 1-0 down to this team of, you know, splendid individuals. Now all we do see is the individuals without the splendid. And it just seems to be that, you know, at times they can perform wonderfully when they're on it and they're pressing high up from the top and filling the box, but it doesn't always happen. And you're not entirely sure who they are. They're a team that sometimes likes to dribble and keep the ball and try to rotate and find ways of getting through. And they, especially if they have Dybala, like you saw against Parma, but sometimes it's all just a little bit slow without anyone in the box. And sometimes they're the team that will counterattack and do a very good job at it. I still don't think they know who they are on a tactical level. This was the first time in 20 years that Atalanta managed to win against Juventus, which tells you quite a lot about where they are at the moment and how much they do no longer scare the opponent. But I do think that Juventus have also been unlucky in that match, as an example. They didn't have Ronaldo. I think it was a deflected goal that had gone in. It's just not a very good team. They are in the start or in the midst of a project or whatever it is that they are trying to create. They're very much the antithesis of what a team should be if they are trying to go to the Super League at the moment. Having said all that, when it came against Parma, I cannot judge this game for you because Parma are just brilliant at letting go of a lead. It was once again a free kick that Ronaldo got blamed at for turning around. He was available for this match. He wasn't very good at all. And the truth is that unfortunately for Parma, they love to score a goal and then they just love to let you down after that. So am I going to take anything away from that? Not very much, except for what's happening with Ronaldo.
Yes, I think it's 20 points from winning positions that Parma have dropped this season, which is the most in Europe's top five leagues. It's I'm not certain of the number 20. I'm certain of the fact that they've dropped the most from winning positions of any team in the top five leagues, which is kind of crazy. Really odd game against Parma because all of Juventus' goals were scored by not the most likely sources, including a brace from Alexandro, whose first goal was really nice, by the way. And I thought it was a very striking image because you got the goal and then, of course, the camera's cut to Agnelli and he's clapping, but he still looks so glum. And, you know, we've already talked about why. We don't need to go back into that. I did think there was one... So Agnelli, talking about the Super League, gave this big interview to two newspapers in Italy, La Repubblica and Corriere dello Sport, and he gave it to both of them. They published it on Wednesday. Of course, on Tuesday night, everything had collapsed. So it was one of those strange interviews that was a bit out of date already, but both still published it because, look, he was talking about why the Super League had happened. But you could see right at the end of this interview, like the very last minute, one of the journalists there had said, oh, by the way, you're still happy you signed Ronaldo. Oh, by the way, you're still happy you chose Pirlo as manager. And so you've got these one-line answers at the end of this big interview about the Super League, about those two topics. And Agnelli dug his heels in on both of them and said, yes, definitely still happy I signed Ronaldo. I'd do it again tomorrow. And the same for Pirlo. So there's another little insight into where his head's at on things. I thought the same thing I've been thinking for weeks about Juventus. I don't have any sense that they're moving in a particularly coherent direction. The Atalanta game wasn't awful. I'd say it was quite a balanced game. And as Mina said, the goal was on a deflected shot from Malinovsky, although once again, not the first time in a match this season where I've looked at it and thought, well, the other manager is making better changes from the bench. Having said that, with Ronaldo out, it was one of those games where you looked at the Juventus bench and thought, where's the striker? Where's just the centre forward for all of the money they've spent and the resources they do have? Where's just another goal scorer? So, look, the second win, the win over Parma, it's really important. Juventus do still need to qualify for the Champions League because Super League ain't happening anytime soon. So it's a good win. It's important. Milan dropping points, but it's just another... I feel like at this point, every week for Juventus, and perhaps even more so for Agnelli after this week, is just another step towards, oh, thank God this is over and we can take a second to regroup.
If it was a meme, it would be a shoulder shrug, kind of, yeah. I tried and failed to get you both to answer me in one word earlier, so I'm going to try this again.
Yeah.
If Juve don't, I know, but if Juve don't finish in the top four, there's practically no chance that they'll keep Pirlo. They're not going to win the league, but if they get Champions League without winning the title, is that enough, yes or no, for Pirlo to keep his job for year two? First of all, Mina.
I think it all depends on who becomes available in the summer.
10 words. Okay, that's not quite a yes or a no. Nikki, can you do us the pleasure of giving me a yes or a no answer?
No. I don't think he should keep his job. So the answer is no.
Oh, he shouldn't. Sorry, he shouldn't. If that was the
question. Right, okay, if you're Agnelli, let's try this again. If you're Agnelli, Mina, keep Pirlo without winning the league but getting into Champions League. Yes or no?
No, but I have to say, it's not Pirlo's fault, but no.
Nikki, if you're Agnelli.
No.
Thank you. Let's talk Inter. A 1-1 draw at Spezia. They went behind. And you know what? We did cut-ins during the Udinese-Cagliari commentary on ESPN. I just wish we'd stayed with Spezia against Inter because it was getting interesting. And then one of the kind of rescue packages of the season, he was so far out of the plans, and then suddenly Ivan Perisic is this world-class, rampaging wing-back who, it's a decent tale of redemption, Nicky. And Perisic got the goal, Inter got the point. And that's another point after the point against Napoli. They're not motoring over the line, but there's plenty in hand, isn't there, to get them there?
Yeah, they're going to get across the line. I mean, actually, we'll talk about it in a second, but Milan lost. So actually drawing extended their lead at the top of the table. I think if Atalanta win tonight, technically they might have shaved a point off Inter's overall lead. Atalanta, who will go second if they win tonight, by the way, which is kind of crazy. When you started talking about Perisic being world class, I thought you were about to say world class, Colin. I was thinking it really wasn't. It was a bit of a bumbled over the line, and it was a bit of a bumbled over sort of striking performance from Inter, because they conceded this goal at the beginning of the game on what was Spezia's, not their only shot on target, their only shot full stop of the entire game they scored from. And Inter then just had a lot of the ball and a lot of not very good work inside the 18-yard box. Even Lukaku, who all of us, and certainly I, have praised the hilt at times this season, he had one of those nights where it felt like he was just going to fall over his own feet every time he got on the ball, and he did have a one-on-one that he definitely should have scored. And Inter had two goals correctly disallowed at the end of the game. If you played this game 100 times, Inter would win it 99 times, I think, but it doesn't matter because they're going to get across the line anyway. I think one thing that was a bit striking to me was thinking back to Antonio Conte's mythology at Juventus. And you think about the season when they got to 100 points, and there was this story about him coming into the changing room when Buffon's been talking to Marotta about the bonuses and they haven't got 100 points yet. And Conte's furious at him, even though they've already won the league, he's furious at him for talking about bonuses, and he tears him up in front of his whole squad and says, you can't have this attitude, basically, of, oh, we've already won the league. It was striking that Conte took a similar line to what I just did of saying, doesn't matter that much, we're going to get there, we're a step closer. I thought that was a change in his, at least his outward persona. But look, I think they need 9 more points now to win the league from the remaining 6 games. And that's still only if the teams behind them win every game. I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I have to say I agree. Although I do take issue with the fact that you said if this game was going to be played, or it's like you didn't give Spezia anything. We love Spezia, don't we?
I do love Spezia.
We love Vincenzo Italiano. And I don't know. I feel like Spezia fancy themselves as a top four team. You know, if there was a Super League, they would definitely be trying to get into it. Yeah. They're the team that seem to really switch on when they're playing very good teams. And they are exceptional at producing performances against Napoli, against Roma, against Juventus, against Inter now. And they are a side that started this game with so much desire. And I think that, you know, maybe Inter were a little bit tired. They did play Napoli over the weekend. and came in sort of a little bit asleep in the beginning and never really, I guess, perhaps recovered the momentum that they're so good at. Exactly that. It just seemed like a game where there are question marks about them when it comes to scoring, because they did have so many shots. I mean, literally Spezia had one and it was on target and it became a goal and that's it, you know? But the way that they organized themselves after the goal, the strict tight lines, it's so delicious to watch, especially when you compare it to all the other teams. He is a genius, Italian. He really is, you know, I'm in love with this man. But for Inter, I do really forget sometimes how much I enjoy Antonio Conte on the sidelines, because as soon as that Spezia goal went in, it's just this, oh, for goodness sakes. and I just love that. It's that kind of like Roy Keane, like, really, guys, really? That kind of, you know, this is who's scoring against us, you know? But it's exactly like Nicky said. I think there is a level of confidence there, which is, it doesn't matter if we, you know, it's understandable. I will say that for somebody like me, who, as much as I enjoy Antonio Conte's dramatics, I'm always someone who, you know, isn't that sure of him. I will say that it worries me sometimes when they do switch off when they are playing every three games, and whether that has something that would scare me going into next season when you are partaking in different competitions. Is this style of play feasible and sustainable? You know, is it something that they can do every 3 days, which they will be tasked with doing, and they need to prove that they are capable of that? I think when you are playing once a week, it's very, you know, enjoyable to play with Conte's tactics and the desire that he puts in. But I think there's still question marks about the heavy schedules and how his sides cope with that.
Just a point of clarification, world class, maybe a stretch, maybe Super League class. I think we can now say that for Perisic, even although it'll never happen. It has been a decent redemption story.
He's been
now,
wonderful.
He has, and it's worked. I remember we commentated on a game, I think it was the start of January. I think it was the first game back at Sampdoria. It was the first game back after the holidays for any of the Italian top flight. And Conte decided to play Perisic in the advance just off the striker role. They lost. He's never been seen in that position again. Yeah. He might have played there when he was younger at other clubs, but that is his niche, that position at wing-back, and no further forward, because he didn't play there again after that defeat against Sampdoria. And finally, Milan. Now, Lazio last year, after the play resumed, went on this horrible run. They'd probably set the bar so high, falsely high, that they couldn't keep up with how high they'd set the bar. And they kind of fell away and there wasn't much of a title challenge. That was last year. This year, Milan are the side that have kind of set the bar a little bit falsely high, given their fans a little bit false hope. And ultimately, performances like the one against Genoa, which they won, and then the one against Sassuolo, which they lost, that kind of sums up the before, i.e. from September through to December, and the after from January through to now for Milan, Mina, because they've thrown away a lot of points since the turn of the year, haven't they?
Yeah, and most of them being at home from the, I think, 6 defeats that they've suffered, 5 have come at home, 10 points or 11 points in 10 games, something like that. There is obviously a problem when it comes to them playing in their own stadium. This is something we did talk about, we've mentioned in an interview with Massimiliano Allegri, who was once the Milan coach. He said that when you feel the San Siro, you know, the atmosphere within that stadium, it is shocking, and I think it's hard, and this is a young squad, so sometimes consistency is not always going to be key to them during this tail end of the season. What I will say on this is that we've spoken about the fact that Juventus need a striker, sometimes somebody to fill the box, and that was especially noticeable against Parma with Dybala and Ronaldo only on the pitch. I do feel sometimes with Ali Ibrahimovic there is a lack there sometimes. Rafael Leao is not somebody who always plays with the level of consistency. They don't fill the box very well. And there is a lack of that ruthless desire. They will sometimes make mistakes when it comes to the final pass and the final decisions. Çalhanoğlu is a player I hugely enjoy watching. Every time he scores a goal, I'm always delighted by the goal that he scores. It's never just a fluke. It's a Quagliarella goal, you know? It's always delicious to watch. I think with them at the moment in time is, you know, there's just, it's just been a long season. It feels like it's lasted forever. And it's exactly that, that's, they're tailing off at the moment. And it always seems to happen at home. What worries me is that they still have Juventus to play. They still have some rather big matches, Atalanta to play coming up. Two more games in the San Siro. So if they perhaps just lose those two and win the next four, they can make top four. But the mood is a little bit negative, I think. And that's also another thing that worries me. But they do need Theo Hernandez, Calabria, Bennacer, Kessié, and Ibrahimovic, because I do think that's the core that needs to be there to ensure success, obviously, as well as Kaya.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before, but I think this is now really starting to look like the top four spot is not safe. It's not safe at all. It's going to be down to the wire for them at this point. I wanted to talk a little bit about Sassuolo, though, because this was a nice win for them. And funnily enough, one of the sort of strange sort of things that came up during the 2 days, especially 2 years, it wasn't quite 2 years, it felt like
it felt like that.
The 2 days of Super League excitement, let's call it. One of the things that came up was this threat of players being excluded from national teams. And I was asked to draw up a starting 11 for Italy without all of the players from Super League teams. And it's funny, the clubs they're suddenly relying on, and one of them is Sassuolo. And you look at Locatelli, who we've talked about a bit and who I love, didn't actually have a great game against Milan, but Domenico Berardi, who I thought did have a really nice game in this one, had a very important assist as well. So Sassuolo have got this lovely sort of collection of a lot of young Italian players, and another one who came off the bench and decided this game, Giacomo Raspadori, who's 21 years old, came up.
He's been captaining the side as well.
Yeah, and has been at the side for more than half his life at 21, which is quite something. You think he's come up from the youth system that long. He's scored both goals. And perhaps for those of us wanting a little bit of strike back for the romantics, and especially with what I said before about De Zerbi and his very passionate remarks before the game, you can't ask for a more meritocratic story than the kid who grew up in the Sassuolo youth team going to San Siro after being in their youth team for 12 years and scoring the two goals that overcame this team that was trying to go off and do something separate with the big guys.
Can I also say that, you know, De Zerbi loves to talk, yeah? And I mean,
Mina is not a De Zerbi enthusiast.
No, I'm really not. I do
He's
think...
He's no Italiano.
You know, when you consider the fact that this is the squad that he has and many of them are Italian internationals, and if we are to take out the players from the top teams and, you know, in the richest teams in Italy, probably, you know, we're not counting Napoli, but then maybe you shouldn't be eighth. It is Raspadori who's been fantastic. I tell you, I look at their squad and I think that sometimes when I listen to Fonseca and all the criticism aimed at them, I think Sassuolo's squad is probably a little bit better, if I'm honest. And I do think that on several occasions, when you are capable of playing the game that you are, and they did stick to their principles in this game and did get the goals, you know, it leaves me disappointed in some of the other matches that they have managed. But also I want to point out that the defense in conceding those two goals, I thought Tomori made a mistake, which is not like him. Kjaer made a mistake to allow the equalizer. Diego Dallo and losing, I forgot his name, I'm sorry, Tialin when he cuts in. And I just thought the defense of Milan is something that has worried me over the last few weeks, when I thought it was rather exceptional because it seemed to be a collective effort in the unity that's shown by Pioli's side in cutting lines and being compact. That seems to have eroded somewhat. And I'm not entirely sure why, because at the moment there's a lot of vulnerability at the back and it is reliant a lot on Kjaer and Tomori making the right decisions all the time. But of course that cannot happen because you cannot expose your defense so often. And that is something that Pioli would need to address if they are trying to make top four.
I just want to end this section before we finish up with a recap of some of the other games. I want to end the section by asking you two who the hipsters' next club's going to be. It was Atalanta. They went mainstream. It was Sassuolo. Then the hipsters were joined by everyone else. They went mainstream. So who are the hipsters going to look out for next season?
Spezia!
It could well be. I do like Italiano. I'm with Mina. Could well be. If not, you know, it's kind of a more obvious choice. But they're still hipster, though. I think maybe they've got great hipster potential because they've got
that
history. No, I was going to say, I think that Torino are back playing good football again and under Nicola. And I think they're going to be better next season than they have been this season. So,
what does that tell you? It tells you nobody should employ Marco Giampaolo. And that Mandragora has been rather fantastic to watch, actually, for them. No?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm not sure it'll be Empoli next season after they went to Serie B. I think the hipsters may look elsewhere. Okay, having no idea where we're picking up from, given there was a heck of a ramble that's probably going to end up on the cutting room floor, why don't we just do a seamless transition into all the Italian teams that are playing in Europe next week? Well, that kind of just leaves us
with... Cruel.
Oh, don't you start. At least you got that far. I mean, how many Scottish teams? Well, Rangers, I suppose, got to the quarterfinals, but never mind. Hearts didn't get anywhere near it. By the way, let's take off on a completely different tangent before we speak about Rangers against Man United. Someone else this week.
Roma versus you. This is a Serie Awesome pod.
I know it. I'm getting to that. Listen.
The Scottish Premier League podcast.
Be quiet. Someone this week posted Diego Maradona of Napoli and his wonderful warm-up prior to the Bayern Munich UEFA Cup semi-final in 1989. Hearts, my team, should have played against Diego Maradona's Napoli. We were 1-0 up against Bayern in the quarter-final, and then they had a disgraceful goal allowed. It should have been that warm-up at Tynecastle Park in Edinburgh. Anyway, I digress, but keeping it seamlessly on topic, with a semi-final of a European competition, Roma taking on Manchester United. Nikki, who's going to go through from this one?
I think Manchester United are the favourites. I think it's probably right that they're the favourites. But look, we've talked a lot all year about Roma not giving us their best performances in the big matches, but they did, away to Ajax, give us one of their best performances in a big match. Not in a showy way. I know a lot of people looked at that match and thought, well, Ajax had more of the ball. They had more of the ball in interesting areas. But I thought it was a really smart game from Fonseca and his players in a difficult spot away from home. So they need to do that again. Resource-wise, it's a non-contest. United have far greater resources at their disposal. I don't think this is the best Roma squad. It's probably one of the weakest Roma squads we've seen for several years, frankly. But you still have Henrik Mkhitaryan having his best season in a very long time. You still have Edin Dzeko, who can decide games when he wants to. You may or may not have Chris Smalling. He's been absent a lot, unfortunately, this season. I don't know if he's going to be fit this week for that game. But they're a team that that needs some of those players to produce, maybe Borja Mayoral as well. But never say never. And Fonseca, certainly, if there's one thing that he showed at Shakhtar, it was that he did have an ability to get more than what his resources offered him on big European nights. So who knows?
Mina?
It's an interesting one because I'm a big fan of Fonseca and a big fan of Roma. Having said all of these things, I agree with Nikki. They haven't exactly always shown themselves to be fantastic against the big opponents. Having said that, I think they're better against sort of teams that hold possession and play the progressive style of football that people like to talk about than they are against teams that have a lot of speed. I think that Lazio destroyed them when they did utilize their speed and their brilliance on the transitions, which is something that we know Manchester United have. And that's what worries me when it comes to Roma. I'm not entirely sure that their back line can contain all the brilliance that there is in United's forward line. One thing that gives me hope is that Solskjaer said that trophies are just for your ego, so perhaps they won't really try because, you know, what does it matter anyway to reach and win trophies, and maybe that will give Roma a chance. But if I'm really honest, I think Milan is a much better team than Roma in general, and they didn't manage it against United, so logic would dictate.
It was a close tie.
It was a close tie, and I thought that we saw the fabulousness of organization that exists in Pioli's team, just the way that they understand their roles in within that. But with Roma's squad, what worries me is, like you said, there are lots of absences and they're not a team that has managed as much as Milan has this season. So logic would say that they wouldn't manage to do as well as Milan. So, and it's only right that United would be favourites considering they at least occupy a place in the top four.
Plus, the other option for Roma, currently seventh in the table behind Lazio, is if they can get by Man United and win the trophy, then potentially five Italian clubs in the Champions League next season. Success, great success. So, like in any meritocratic or bureaucratic meeting, at the end, the chairman shall say to those involved, any other business? Nikki.
I think we've covered all of the main things that I wanted to talk about today. We could keep talking about the Super League for another two days, certainly, if we wanted to, but I think we've covered it. Yeah, I think we've covered it.
Mina.
I don't know. Do you want to talk a little bit? Because I do feel like Semplici needs a little bit of, you know, a pat on the shoulder for his win against Parma, for another win against Udinese. They are climbing that table, good old Cagliari. Like, you know, we really wanted to see it because their team is good. But I'm sure that you're very disappointed having been the man in charge of that game.
The problem with that game, though, well, not there wasn't a problem with the getting the all 3 points, but Benevento getting a point at Genoa in a crazy 20-minute spell where all the goals were scored, and Torino doing their thing as well at Bologna. It might be too little too late, but there is something that Cagliari has right now. Parma, forget about it. They've been bad. You mentioned earlier about how many points that they've dropped. Torino went through the spell where if they were 2-0 up, that was a concern.
Yes.
Because But this time it's Parma who, when you're 3-1 up, then 3-2 up in stoppage time at Cagliari, and that can really, there's a 6-point swing there, which would be absolutely huge. And then you go and concede two in stoppage time. They've got something. They've got the bit between their teeth right now, Cagliari. The problem is Torino's still got a game in hand. And who knows what's going to go on with Benevento. But at least we've got something at the bottom of the table. We've got one place left to play for. And we will talk about that. We will talk about Roma next week against Manchester United in the Europa League. And we will talk about Inter potentially being another 3 points or even one towards the first title since Jose Mourinho's men in 2010. I won't be talking about anything next week because Bonetti and co. will have moved house and will be back to entertain in 7 days' time. Thank you for your company, and we'll do it all again soon. Bye for now.